I'm Lisa Mullins in Boston, along with Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now. Today, President Biden has announced new sanctions against Russia and said more could be on the way.
As Russia contemplates its next move, we have our next move prepared as well. Russia will pay an even steeper price if it continues its aggression, including additional sanctions.
For more, we're joined now by NPR's national security correspondent, Greg Myrie. Greg, we heard President Biden call Russia's actions the beginning of an invasion, and that apparently has triggered the sanctions he announced just a short time ago. What is he doing to retaliate against President Putin's aggression in Ukraine?
Right. He announced a number of sanctions on two Russian banks, not the biggest banks. One is a development bank. The other is a military bank. Also said Russia can't get financing for its debt in the West. So these are real things. They're probably not going to make Vladimir Putin upend any plans he might have. But I think it's important to see this in the context of a series of sanctions that could come from the U.S., from Europe, all designed to ratchet up the pressure on Russia and hopefully force Putin to recalculate his thinking. But it's clear the U.S. wasn't ready to pour out all its potential sanctions at once.
I want to ask you about other potential sanctions in a second. But first, the condemnation has already been coming in from Western Europe. The U.K. announced sanctions. Germany said it would not turn on Nord Stream 2, the natural gas pipeline from Russia. How has Russia responded to the actions?
Well, it's saying, portraying itself as a victim. It keeps saying that it was threatened by Ukraine. It's had to, civilians in eastern Ukraine have had to evacuate into Russia. Russia has claimed there was Ukrainians were carrying out genocide, all with no proof or no evidence. But again, trying to create the narrative that Russia is the victim, that this is all part of a plan to punish Russia and threaten its security. That's been the Russian response. They haven't backed off. Again, they've said both the President Putin and the parliament have authorized the use of Russian troops in the separatist region in eastern Ukraine.
And I know Vladimir Putin is saying at least that he didn't watch President Biden's comments. Biden says there are other sanctions that he's holding back on. Do the U.S. and its allies have many additional economic levers at their disposal if Russian hostilities increase?
Oh, they certainly do. And again, I think this is an effort to roll them out in stages and not do them all at once. Again, the sort of nuclear option would be to cut Russia off from international banking, the so-called SWIFT sanctions. But that doesn't seem to be on the table right now. It seems that there's going to be this measured increase in sanctions. Russia is looking at operating its military in the eastern Ukraine, in the separatist area. But these additional sanctions could come into play if Russia goes deeper inside Ukraine. President Biden said all the indications are that Russia is prepared to do that. He wouldn't be surprised. He hopes he's wrong. But these additional levers could be put into place. But again, there's just the question of whether any level of sanctions, even a complete divorce and refusal to cooperate with Russia, would change President Putin's plan. The hope is it will. It's not clear if it would.
So the question is diplomacy even on the table anymore? Because the Secretary of State, Antony Blinken, was planning to meet later this week with his counterpart in Russia as a prelude to a potential meeting between Vladimir Putin and Joe Biden. Could that even happen?
Well, President Biden said the U.S. is still open to diplomacy, but then he was quick to add if Russia is serious. So he certainly seemed to be injecting some skepticism as to whether Russia is even open to serious talks. And again, it will probably depend on what we see on the ground in Ukraine. Secretary of State Antony Blinken had sort of tentatively planned to meet with his Russian counterpart on Thursday. They hadn't finalized that meeting, and we're also not hearing that it's called off. So it seems to be in a little bit of limbo, and I expect the events on the ground in the next day or two will dictate whether there's a diplomatic meeting.
We will talk to you again. Thank you. NPR National Security Correspondent Greg Myrie. Thanks, Greg.
My pleasure.
President Biden promised tougher sanctions on Russia today for what U.S. officials are now calling an invasion of Ukraine. And that is the sound of Russian tanks in eastern Ukraine sent in yesterday as part of what the Russian president, Vladimir Putin, has called a peacekeeping mission. We've been talking about that. Pro-Russian separatists have been fighting in the region since 2004. So we're going to get the view from the ground there now. Mike Eckel is senior correspondent for Radio Free Europe and Radio Liberty. That is a radio network that is funded and supported by the U.S. government. It was created during the Cold War to disseminate information in Europe. And Mike, welcome. You're near the border of the disputed territories now. What are you seeing there as the tensions seem to escalate by the moment?
We spent most of today at a town fairly close to what's known as the line of control. It's called Novoluhansk. And it's, you know, it's pretty much a frontline position. The village itself is emptied of residents. It has been emptying for several years now. In fact, just yesterday, there was one of the more serious shelling incidents. A couple of mortars fell right into a neighborhood on the outskirts of the city. And one man was killed. Windows blown out. They blew out the central heating system for this neighborhood. So people are definitely more nervous.
I want to get to the shelling in just a moment. But first, President Putin, Vladimir Putin, has sent troops into this region now. Have you seen any sign of the Russian military buildup from where you are?
One of my Ukrainian colleagues spent some time overnight, late night, closer to the city of Donetsk, which is held by separatist forces and has been for almost 8 years. And he reported seeing heavy Russian equipment moving along adjacent roads, like armored personnel carriers and troop carriers and that type of thing.
But there is this shelling that you mentioned, and it has been increasing over the past few days. Russia says it is the Ukrainians who are attacking the Russian separatists. The United States says it is Russia that is using that as an excuse to send in these troops. From what you can tell, where is the shelling coming from?
Indeed, it's a really hard thing to pinpoint. And as you started out by saying, the shelling has intensified over the past, you know, not just a couple days, but a week or more. International monitors have been recording just a really alarming spike in ceasefire violations. That includes, you know, small arms gunfire. That includes heavier weaponry, mortars, artillery, and yeah, the two sides, you know, say no, they did it. No, they did it. And but to say definitively, like, it's only the Russian separatists or it's only the Ukrainian government forces, I haven't seen any sort of evidence to give a definite answer about who's targeting what.
What was the reaction there in eastern Ukraine to President Putin's speech yesterday where he called Ukraine essentially a colony of Russia and said it never really was a legitimate country in the first place? How's that going over?
So, you know, we talked to quite a few people today, mainly in Novoluhansk. And, you know, for a lot of people, the primary thing in their lives is just trying to get a semblance of normalcy. They're trying to, you know, go do their grocery shopping and trying to make sure their bills are paid, trying to make sure their windows are taped up so they don't get blasted out, make sure their kids go to school. So, you know, I didn't hear from anyone this sense of outrage or this sense of burning anger about the things that Putin had to say about Ukraine. That said, you know, this is a part of Ukraine that is, it's very much kind of a mixing pot of identities and languages and you know, there's no hard and fast dividing line between Ukrainians and Russians. You know, Ukrainian and Russian language are pretty much interchangeable, and people have relatives on both sides of the borders and they intermarry, and so, you know, this kind of talk about identity and history, it kind of gets lost for a lot of people in the daily demands of life and trying to get on with your life while living on the edge of a war zone.
The United States has placed new sanctions on the disputed territories of Ukraine. We know there are more coming. From your point of view, are there sanctions that would stop Russia and Vladimir Putin from moving forward with an invasion?
Well, in terms of stopping it, it's an interesting question. This is something that the Ukrainian president, Volodymyr Zelensky, has kind of hammered home over past weeks as the threats from Russia have built. He's said, why is the talk about putting sanctions in place after the Russians do something? And he said, why don't we put them in place now? You know, given the depth and the gravity of Putin's grievances and his view on Ukraine, you know, I'm not sure there's anything that can be done from the West right now that would forestall what's coming down the pike.
Mike Eckel is a senior correspondent for Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty. He's reporting from Eastern Ukraine. Mike, thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Aaron Bryant curates photography at the Smithsonian. He looks at American history through an African-American lens every day, not just during Black History Month. Bryant recently shared his thoughts about two of his favorite images of Harlem.
My name is Aaron Bryant, and I'm curator of photography and visual culture at the National Museum of African-American History and Culture. I would say there are a number of photos that are Harlem Renaissance or Harlem Renaissance-esque. Most certainly the first image that comes to my mind would be a photograph that we have of Gladys Bentley. And she was a performer during the Harlem Renaissance. And what I like about her story is that Ms. Bentley performed in drag. She performed as a drag king. So she wore, you know, a tuxedo. She had dancing girls who were actually men in drag. And so, you know, even during the 1920s, you had someone who was really pushing the envelope on gender identity and sexual orientation and what it meant to be a man or a woman, and how she shows us a very different kind of Harlem. Today we talk about pronouns, but she was, you know, Gladys Bentley was interrogating pronouns during the turn of the century, during the early part of the 20th century, during the Harlem Renaissance. And I think the images that we have of her in our collection are really amazing, and they say something really important to me about Harlem at that moment in time. Another one of my favorite photographs, I would say, would be the Elks Parade in Harlem, taken by Jack Manning in 1938. This most certainly is an epic photograph. I remember seeing a set from Porgy and Bess, and you know, watching a scene where there were people who were singing from the windows. And there are people lining the fire escapes. They're looking outside the windows. They're sitting on top of roofs to watch this elk parade. And it's very much a scene from an opera. It's just so dramatic. And it's almost like the entire community in Harlem came out to watch this Elks parade. So in addition to being a beautiful photograph and important in documenting life in Harlem, I think it says so much about joy and community and the sense of community, what brought people together, what kept people moving and motivated during the 1930s while they lived in Harlem.
Aaron Bryant, curator of visual culture at the National Museum of African American History and Culture. He spoke with NPR's Walter Ray Watson Jr. You can see a picture of Gladys Bentley, Josephine Baker in Paris, and a rare image of a Black Civil War soldier now online at NPR.org.
For many of us, an egg is just an egg. It comes from a cardboard carton. It's white or brown, usually. What more do you need to know? Well, for Lisa Steele, the answer is just about everything. Steele is a fifth-generation Maine farmer, chicken keeper, and author. Among the things she knows, there are myths about eggs. There are secret codes on those cardboard boxes. There are foundational techniques for steaming, baking, and frying eggs. There are recipes for eggs for everything, including cocktails. Steele reveals it all in her new cookbook called Fresh Eggs Daily. Lisa, thank you for joining us.
Oh, thank you for having me. The pleasure is all mine.
So, well, mine too, because I love eggs. I'll say it right out, not runny ones, but who cares? Is your new cookbook in which you wax poetic about your favorite hen, Miranda, and holding one of her warm, fresh eggs. Is this kind of an exercise and pleasure for you?
Absolutely. The book did sort of start out like a novel. Every morning going down and letting the chickens out and feeding them and then peeking into the nest boxes looking for eggs, it's magical. Every time I pull an egg out of the nest, I just can't believe that the chickens can do this day after day.
So you know a fresh egg, and it's not always easy to get a fresh egg. Not everybody has a chicken in the backyard. So how do we know when we go to the store how fresh an egg is?
It can be sort of difficult unless you know the secret. On the end of each egg carton, there's usually a best by or a sell by date, and you can sort of ignore those. But what you want to look for is the 3-digit code, and it's going to be a number between 001 and 365. And that signifies the day of the year that those eggs were put in the carton. So 001 is January 1st and 365 is December 31st. So you want to look at the numbers and pick the highest number. So that's the date that's closest to the day that you're standing in front of that array of tons and tons of eggs.
But isn't the expiration date or sell-by date somehow based on that? Or are you saying they have nothing to do with each other?
It is, but it's more arbitrary.
Oh, wow. And how about looking at them? I was told once that if they have a lot of spots or marks, then they are less fresh. Is that true?
No.
Okay, there goes that.
That's just a little bit of a pigment glitch when the chicken was applying the color to the eggshell. There's really no way to look at an egg to tell if it's fresh or not. But if you hold it up to your ear and shake it, if you can kind of feel movement and hear something sloshing around inside, the egg is not super fresh because air has gotten in, moisture has escaped, and there's room inside. Whereas if you take a fresh egg and you shake it, nothing's going to move because that egg is just full of the yolk and the white.
How about in the glass of water trick?
In the glass of water, the float test, yes. That I use often. And the float test will tell you how fresh an egg is. You fill a glass of water, and if you put the egg in it, if it sits on the bottom, the egg is super fresh. And then as it ages, it starts to rise a little because that air is getting in through the pores in the eggshell. And if the egg is floating, it might not be bad, but it's really old.
Which means it doesn't taste as good?
Yeah, and there's more chance of bacteria being in it.
Some of the other good tips that you have. When we crack an egg, you say we should do it on a flat surface. Why?
Yeah, so many people crack an egg on a bowl or the edge of a counter. But when you do it that way, there's a chance that you're going to push little pieces of eggshell or any bacteria that is on that eggshell into the egg. And by doing it on a flat surface, you eliminate that problem. So it should always be on the counter or on the cutting board.
And warmth is important when you're baking or cooking eggs. You say that they should always be on the warm side. Why is that?
Yes, if your recipe calls for room temperature eggs, then it means room temperature eggs. If you add cold eggs or any cold ingredient to a batter or a dough, it's going to cause the fats to seize up and not incorporate as well.
And how about the color? Is there any difference between brown and white eggs, or for that matter, blue and green eggs?
No. All eggs start out white, and then some breeds have brown pigment, some have blue pigment, so they apply that color to the outside of the eggshell.
And they don't taste any different? Or the consistency isn't any different?
Nope, they're exactly the same inside.
Okay, let's talk about taste. The cookbook that you wrote has recipes for every meal, so let's start off with breakfast and a recipe that looks so decadent and so delicious, but surprisingly is easy to make. This is fried eggs and apricot jam and goat cheese. This comes from your Finnish mother?
Yes. As soon as my mother knew I was writing a cookbook, she obviously, you know, got excited and started sending me all sorts of egg recipes. But this was one that she actually made, and she enjoys it all the time. And I loved it because the apricot jam isn't super sweet like some other jams or jellies are. But on top of the egg yolk, it matches in color. And then some goat cheese sprinkled on the egg white is just such a nice flavor contrast. It's just a very strange recipe, but it works somehow.
Heading to the brunch section, you feature these gorgeous blueberry popovers that include blueberry jam and blueberry butter. Popovers can be difficult, and they can be fussy. How difficult is a popover to make, and how do they feature your beloved eggs?
Popovers really aren't hard. I think the key is having a popover pan, although you can make them in a muffin tin. Mm. The egg is really the only leavening agent, which is making the popovers rise. The key is not opening the oven until they've popped and really firmed up and are almost done cooking. If you keep peeking, they're not going to rise.
And what's a popover pan?
It's just basically a muffin tin with deep cups in it.
I see. Another recipe that caught our eye is, because there was such a striking photograph, is baked eggs in butternut squash rings, which looks so simple and elegant. Can you describe it for us?
I love that one. That's one of my favorites. Not only is it really eye-catching because the orange of the butternut squash matches the bright orange egg yolks, but it's a really nice dinner option if you're trying to cut back a little on red meat, or say you're serving dinner and you have vegetarians coming. And so easy, too, because you're just baking it in a pan.
It's a butternut squash ring that's pre-cooked, and then you drop the egg in the middle?
Right. So the butternut squash is going to take longer to cook than an egg will. Eggs cook pretty quickly. So you're baking the butternut squash, sort of pre-baking it, I guess, with some olive oil, and you can add some fresh herbs, salt and pepper, whatever. And then when the butternut squash are almost done, you're going to drop your eggs in and then bake them just until your eggs are cooked. You said you don't like runny yolks, so you might want to cook yours a little bit longer.
Thank you for paying attention. No one else does. I would cook mine a little bit longer, but are you saying the best way to do them is to have them be runny?
I'm a big fan of a jammy egg. You know, whether you're dipping some toast strips into it or you're just breaking the yolk and it's, you know, spreading over your plate. I do like a runny yolk, but it's personal preference, you know, no judgment.
You feature cocktails, and I guess most of us know about eggnog, but you've got a lime bourbon sour and a maple sour and a sunny side up sidecar. Tell us about eggs and drinks.
Yes, eggs actually have a very long history of being added to drinks, not only eggnog, like you mentioned, but an egg flip, which is a very, very old traditional colonial drink, I believe. I am just a whiskey sour girl, and when you shake some egg white foam and strain out your whiskey sour and have that nice layer of foam on top, it's a really beautiful drink. The maple sour is delicious.
Always uncooked eggs in drinks, cocktails?
Yes.
Your desserts are pretty spectacular. Many of them, cakes and pies, homemade marshmallows. But tell us about this one that really caught my eye. The photograph is gorgeous. Orange brandy olive oil cake. It looks dense, almost like a pudding, but kind of a crummy pudding.
Yes. Olive oil cakes sort of are the rage, and I wasn't sure if I wanted to include one because you know how trends come and go so fast. But the olive oil cake is really unique because you're using olive oil instead of butter in it, and the cake stays so moist. You can leave it out on the counter for at least a week, and it's not going to dry out. It's something you can make well in advance if you're having people over or if you need to bring it somewhere. And I love it. I mean, the orange juice, the orange liqueur, and the olive oil just makes for a really nice cake. But you're right, it's super dense. You know, you don't need to serve huge pieces of it.
No, probably not even ice cream on top. You don't need it.
No, just a little powdered sugar and a little bit more of the glaze. It's a nice recipe.
So before we let you go, are there any more pro tips you can give us non-experts? And I say that because producer Karen Miller-Medson wanted me to say it on your favorite ingredient, eggs.
You know, I would just say I think people tend to overcook their eggs. Eggs cook so, so fast. So cook them slowly over low heat and make sure you take them off just a little bit before they're done because they're going to cook even from the pan to the plate.
Thank you. That's chef, author, and chicken raiser Lisa Steele on her new cookbook, Fresh Eggs Daily. For some of those recipes and photographs, go to our website, hereandnow.org. Lisa, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Russian President Vladimir Putin has sent troops into two separatist regions of eastern Ukraine and recognized them as independent, not part of Ukraine. President Putin is justifying this move by stating his own version of history. In a televised address yesterday, he said modern Ukraine was an invention created by Russia after the 1917 revolution, and he claimed that Ukraine was given independence by a weak, crumbling Soviet Union. He implies that Ukraine isn't a sovereign state or that it or parts of it belong to Russia. Joining us is Nina Khrushcheva, who is a professor of international affairs at the New School in New York. Professor, welcome.
Thank you very much.
What is Vladimir Putin saying that recasts the history of Ukraine and Russia? What is he saying that to you is patently wrong?
Basically, the message was don't rile the Russian bear, the bear that I understand we are, not the way it is being in legal documents, legal institutions, geopolitical treaties, and so on and so forth. And I think that is a rewriting of history on a mythological scale rather than really both geopolitical and realistic scale.
Right. It's history the way Vladimir Putin would
exactly.
like to present
history
it.
History according to Vladimir Putin, yes.
So what is the reality of how Ukraine was created? Because it was at one point one of several, the number at one point was 15 Soviet socialist republics. All of them are now independent countries. What is right and what is wrong about his reasoning?
Everything is wrong about his reasoning, because that was a completely revisionist history. And even if some elements of it may be true, as George Orwell used to say, all propaganda lies even if it tells the truth, because it is put together in a way that it becomes a lie. Well, of course, as Kiev and Rus was a protostate for both Russia and Ukraine in the 800s. So that was the original story, that Russia was baptized by Vladimir the Great, that Putin sees himself as a descendant of. And that's how, in fact, through history, the Russian Tsars and then the Soviet leaders saw Ukraine as it's even the name of it in Russian is Malorossiya, which is small Russia, and Ukraine means on the edge. So they've seen it as kind of an appendage to the big Russia. There's always been a bit of animosity between the Russians and Ukrainians, because Ukrainians always didn't want to be condescended upon, and the Russians always look at them as the smaller Russia. So that, in this sense, Putin is really not so much outside of the general tradition of Russian and Soviet leaders, and I must say, except for Nikita Khrushchev, who thought that Ukrainians are the greatest and a wonderful nation and deserve all the independence and recognition and respect they deserve.
Could you explain how Ukraine voted to break away from the Soviet Union back in 1991?
Well, it was the dissolution of the Soviet Union, as was instigated by Boris Yeltsin, who was the president of Russia at the time. The Ukrainian president and the Belarusian president in the woods of Belarus. And so they signed this agreement of dissolution of the Soviet Union. So Ukraine was part of that process. What Putin is saying is that Ukraine itself, or at least the parts that now being recognized as independent, they were part of the so-called Novorossiya, which is a new Russia. And it was those borderlands that were Ukraine peasants, Russian workers, and so on and so forth. And then with Vladimir Lenin and the revolution, Putin doesn't like revolutions, that became that Republic of Ukraine. So what Putin is saying, that before the Soviets, that was the right proper kind of correlation of importance between Russia and part of the Russian Empire, Ukraine.
The situation has been evolving between Ukraine and the West in ways that Vladimir Putin doesn't like. What does he have to gain by bringing Ukraine, or trying to, back into the fold, or at least part of it?
He sees himself on the waves of history. He fashions himself in Vladimir the Great, and he sees himself in his footsteps, sort of Peter the Great, Catherine the Great, all the greats before. So what he's trying to say is that ultimately we are the same nation, we're the same people, and you just got brainwashed, you Ukrainians, and you know, you belong to us. The question is whether it's a metaphoric threat or metaphor, and he doesn't mean to take the whole Ukraine, but only wants the New Russia, so to speak, parts of New Russia, or at least some parts of New Russia, or he's really preparing to take over the whole country. I mean, I continue to believe that it's more of a sort of the lands he can take, not the lands he wants to take. So probably he will stop here. And in fact, one of the indicators is that originally they announced that the troops will go into Donetsk and Luhansk regions to keep the peace, but now they actually backed off that. So there is a recognition, but still there is no, technically there's no invasion and there is no incursion, so to speak, which suggests that Putin is now recalculating his forceful steps and maybe is going to be more dialogue.
Nina, thank you very much. Nina Krusheva, Professor of International Affairs at the New School in New York. Thanks again.
Thank you.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Lisa Mullins in Boston.
And I'm Peter O'Dowd in Phoenix. This is Here and Now.